recording devices, options that commercial carriers have fought because of the added cost. How soon the transition can take place is uncertain, as it will require a sophisticated global satellite system to record all the data from the thousands of planes that are aloft at any one moment. For NPR News, I'm Frank Browning.
Fire crews appear to be making headway in that 148,000-acre wildfire near Los Angeles. It's now more than 40% contained. Meanwhile, authorities are investigating the station fire as a homicide after two firefighters were killed. The fire started nearly 2 weeks ago and grew into the largest blaze ever in Los Angeles County. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 40 points at last check at 9,385. NASDAQ up 20 at 2,003. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. The University of Illinois Band Program is the world's largest and one of its most distinguished. On the Friday edition of Live and Local, we'll meet the new director of bands, Robert Rumbelow. We'll also hear an Argentinian instrument called the bandoneon, played by Julian Labro. Both men are in town for performances at the Allerton Music Barn Festival in Monticello. It's Live and Local, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Champaign Park District. The Champaign Park District and the Champaign-Urbana Symphony present Symphony at Sunset to kick off the 50th anniversary of the CU Symphony at Dodds Park on Saturday, September 19th. There will be an instrument petting zoo, entertainment, and food vendors before the concert at 7 p.m. More information is at champaignparkdistrict.com.
This is Focus 580. I'm David Inge, and glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Korea, both North and South Korea. And our guest is someone who has been following politics of Korea for quite a long time. His name is Ed Baker. His particular personal involvement with the country goes back to the mid-60s, when he went to Korea as part of the first Peace Corps group to go to the country, and ever since has been teaching about and learning about that country. He has had a long affiliation with the Harvard Yenching Institute that has been around actually for a long time, longer than he is, I think, founded in 1928, has been interested in all that time in doing research, teaching, publication on issues relating to East Asia. He also is involved with the Korea Institute at Harvard that is essentially interested in doing the same thing, promoting research and teaching about Korea. He was in Korea recently and, of course, has spent a lot of time there over the years, and we thought it would be interesting to talk a little bit about the country, about the North and the South, relations between the two, relations between North Korea and the rest of the world, between North Korea and the United States, and I'm sure that we could take questions from people who are listening. Questions, comments, certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, certainly questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are as brief as they can be so that we can keep things moving along. I hope certainly people would keep their questions focused on the topic, but otherwise, callers are welcome. Well, Mr. Baker, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
I thought it might give us a way to talk about Korea and perhaps how things in Korea have changed over the past couple of decades. If the way to do that would be for me to ask you to talk about Kim Dae-jung, a man who just recently passed away and someone who I believe you know quite well. And I think that you were actually in Korea at the time that his funeral was held. Someone who has had a remarkable career in Korean politics, going from being an opponent to the government to being the president, is someone who is often compared to Nelson Mandela in terms of his significance in Korea. Tell us a little bit about Kim Dae-jung.
Well, Kim Dae-jung was a lifelong advocate of the democratization of Korea. And for that, he was once kidnapped from Japan and threatened with being thrown into the ocean. And U.S. intervention and probably Japanese intervention prevented that. But he was transported directly to his house, and he remained in the house under house arrest for – which, by the way, was not a provision of the Korean legal system. There's no such thing. But in fact, there, he was kept under house arrest for about 5 years. And at a later point, he was sentenced to death on trumped-up charges of trying to overthrow the government. Once again, the U.S. finally reacted and his life was saved. But all along, the U.S. could have done a lot and didn't do much until 1987, when there was a popular uprising, which was oriented to change the Constitution to provide for direct election of the president, because the two previous presidents had set up systems that were designed just to keep them in power and provided for indirect elections. And the second on their list of demands was the restoration of the political and civil rights of Kim Dae-jung. It was a long road even from there to his becoming president. It took another 10 years. But he was elected in 1997. He handled the so-called IMF crisis, which I don't think is quite a fair way of designating it, but that's how it's usually characterized in Korea, which was an economic crisis that was much more confined to Asia than our current one. But it required a drastic restructuring of the Korean economy and limiting the power of the big – they're called chaebol in Korea – in Korean. They are the big economic conglomerates, which were really controlling the Korean economy in conjunction with the Korean government. It's interesting to note that our former president, who – president of Harvard, I mean, who left here under a cloud, was one of President Kim's advisors in solving that problem. But the most important thing that he did, and I'm sure that he would agree with me, was his approach to North Korea. The peninsula has been divided in two since 1945. There was nothing but acrimony until the 1990s. No progress toward peace at all. There is an armistice in place, and fortunately it remains in place, but no progress toward actual peace settlement. And Kim managed to arrange to have a summit meeting with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-il, who is still the leader we're reading about in today's New York Times, for example. And they issued a joint communique which provided for peaceful negotiation of issues between North and South, for southern aid to North Korea, and was the basis for setting up the industrial zone at Kaesong, which is the only cooperative economic venture between the two countries, and the tourist zone at Mount Kumgang, which is the most famous scenic site in all of Korea, certainly in North Korea, but in all of Korea. These were proud achievements, and his successor, No Mu-hyun, extended these, although No Mu-hyun did not have the same kind of charismatic presence that Kim Dae-jung did. And then the current government under Lee Myung-bak began to chip away at it and made it clear that they were not feeling that he was not feeling really committed to these agreements that the South Korean government had signed. And this really soured the relations. And Mr. Kim, at the age of 85 and in poor health, but still with all his mental faculties intact, spoke out frequently on these problems. He was disappointed with the Obama administration's lack of action, and he was really angry with Lee Myung-bak's negative actions. And the press flocked to his house to interview him because he was the most persuasive voice speaking on issues of tremendous import to all Koreans.
Just one thing, maybe it would be appropriate to mention that for his work in trying to improve relations between the North and the South, Mr. Kim in year 2000 was awarded the Nobel Prize, Nobel Peace Prize.
Right. It was quite careless of me to have left that out.
Please go ahead.
I happened to be in Daegu the night that was announced. Mm-hmm. Daegu is in the southeastern part of Korea. There is strong regional feeling in Korea between the southeast and the southwest, and Kim was from the southwest. I was in a restaurant, and when the announcement was made over the TV, the whole place went up in cheers. So I took that as a real sign of national solidarity.
Uh-huh. I was certainly struck by reading the stories about Mr. Kim's funeral and about the fact that the North sent a delegation and that it was seen as at least an opportunity to lay some groundwork for, again, getting back to having both governments talking to one another and seeing if perhaps they could again make some progress.
I think that's absolutely correct. I know that Kim would be pleased to know that his death actually produced the first movement in the direction that he always advocated, that is negotiation to try and solve our differences. And he was very clear about the differences. He was very critical of North Korea for its very belligerent statements that it had been making this spring, for example. He said, this has got to stop. But also, our government, the South Korean government, has got to affirm that it is committed to the two agreements that have been made. And so I know that he would really have been pleased to know that the North sent a delegation of six very prominent members of the party and the government, and the current president received them at the presidential mansion. And I believe that if he were following his gut instincts, he would not have done that. I think he did it. He received them because the public had reached the point of insisting, and that he would have caused himself even more domestic problems if he hadn't done that.
The guest here with us this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Edward Baker. He's senior project manager with the Harvard Yenching Institute and has a long
association. No longer.
No, that's not. Well, I must.
That's out of date.
Apologize because I was a little frustrated in finding a current kind of bio, and I certainly want to try to be. We should have asked.
I am an associate of the Harvard Yenching Institute and a member of the executive committee of the Harvard Korea Institute.
All right, very good.
And a professor at Hanyang University in Seoul.
Well, and certainly someone who has been following Korean politics for a long time and indeed has had a long association with the Harvard Yenching Institute, which is interested in promoting research and teaching about East Asia, China particularly, but also the rest of East Asia.
Yes, that's right.
We have a caller to talk with, and so let us do that. Someone who is in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I just started listening to the Bakers talking. It seems to me that Dr. Baker is quite supportive of President Kim Dae-jung's policy on Korean unification. My question is, I'm from Korea. I know a lot of debate on whether his so-called sunshine policy is really effective in terms of containment of North Korean's nuclear policy, etc. So I would like to hear his opinion on his sunshine policy.
Well, from 1945 through the Korean War, a terrible experience for everyone on the peninsula and everyone who was sent there to fight. And I'm sure for the Chinese guys who were volunteers, quote unquote, fighting in Korea, just a horrible event or set of events. And then absolutely no progress for many, many years until 1988. In 1988, George Bush Sr. made it clear that the U.S. had withdrawn its tactical nuclear weapons from South Korea. That was the first diminution in the American nuclear threat to North Korea since the Korean War. We explicitly, President Truman and General MacArthur, explicitly threatened North Korea with nuclear bombs. Fortunately, it didn't come to that. But the situation remained an absolute standoff. And in the 1990s, I won't go into all the details unless we have time later, but some progress was made in the form of the 1994 Geneva Accords negotiated by Robert Gallucci, who was then a State Department official, and North Korean negotiators. And from that point, things improved. Under those accords, the U.S. and North Korea were to move toward diplomatic relations. No progress on that front. North Korea agreed to rejoin the NPT, Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, and to shut down its facility at Yongbyon. And they did it, and international inspectors were there from 1994 until 2002. There was a big improvement if you consider, as I do, diminishing the threat of war is an improvement. A war on the Korean Peninsula would be a horrible repeat of the Korean War, and perhaps wider, perhaps involving actual damage to China and Japan, and certainly tremendous damage to South Korea, a place I love and don't want to see bombed or artillery shelled. So then all along, though, the relations between the North and South didn't improve very much, although the framework for peace was certainly improved. And then Kim took the next step, which was to negotiate this agreement with Kim Jong-il. And, you know, some conservatives in South Korea now are talking about the lost decade and so forth. I can't understand what they're talking about. There was a peaceful situation for the next 9 years. Yes?
Can I interfere?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
But in terms of the sustainability of the North Korean regime, many people doubt that Kim Jong-il is sustainable within next decade or so. So in terms of, first, in terms of humanitarian perspective, it should have been better just to let the Kim Jong-il die off. But unfortunately, the Sunshine Policy led to a financial contribution to like thousands of millions of dollars flowed in North Korea, which, you know, probably, possibly helped create those nuclear momentum, etc. So many right-wing or conservative public opinion in Korean population, a lot of kind of criticize of that Sunshine Policy.
Well, I'm well aware of that, and I think it is totally misguided. And I know it's a minority opinion. I have been there for the last 7 months. I only returned from Korea about 72 hours ago. I was at the funeral. I saw the city in mourning. And I saw the city mourning before that for Nomu-hyun, who hadn't been popular, nearly as popular as Kim Dae-jung. But when he took his own life, he galvanized the whole country in a way that I was astonished to see. A million people probably between Gyeongbok Palace and Seoul Station, all wearing these yellow sun visors. It was incredible. And Kim's death has galvanized the country. It forced Im Young-bak to receive a North Korean delegation, which came in the midst of the most acrimonious situation that had existed since before 2000. And if you think that Kim Jong-il is still alive because of this, then I don't know what you're talking about. Kim Jong-il is 67 years old, like I am, and he has control of the place. And if you think that he would have faded away, you're living in a dream world.
Yeah, thank you very much. I would like to hear more about the U.S. policy, U.S. Foreign policy in terms of in terms of the effectiveness or lack of effectiveness of the Sunshine Policy from you later. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And maybe what I would do here is that I would think that you would argue that at this point they have a good opportunity, the United States has a good opportunity to start again or perhaps get things on a more positive footing in terms of the relationship between the United States and the North, and
yes,
that certainly would have implications for the relationship between the North and the South.
Between the South and the U.S.
The relationship between both the North and the South, each other, and the United States. Are we at a particularly advantageous time now for doing that?
Well, we had been at a particularly disadvantageous time with the repudiation of the agreements by the Im Young-bak government. That government cut back on every kind of cooperation, even a program to provide materials for testing for TB, which is a continuous problem in North Korea. That program was suspended, which program could only be characterized as a purely humanitarian program. Things were getting rougher and nastier by the day. The U.S. Obama administration, about which many of us had extremely high hopes, was doing nothing. And the North Koreans reacted, as anyone who knows anything about them would expect, by making lots of tough statements, by testing missiles, eventually testing even another nuclear device, and trying to show, like a peacock spreading its tail or a wild turkey spreading its tail, how big and tough it was, which is its reaction to fear. It fears, it lives in fear, as former Secretary of Defense William Perry recognized in the 90s. It lives in fear of American nuclear bombing. And that is why it has developed nuclear weapons, or if they have nuclear weapons. They have exploded some kind of nuclear device. I don't know what that means in terms of deliverability and whether they really could do anything with them. But they want everybody to believe that they could. And the world has reacted, of course, by getting very upset about it. it's then we come to the death of Kim Dae-jung, and wisely, I believe, and pacifically, Kim Jong-il decided to send a delegation of high-ranking officials, and the South Korean government really couldn't say no. Even if Im Young-bak in his heart of hearts wanted to say no, he couldn't say no because it excited the whole country and pleased people, because people don't want war. They don't want continuing tension. And the tension had been dramatically reduced, and then it was being cranked up again. Right now, Stephen Bosworth, the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, is on a trip to East Asia. He's talking to the Chinese, the Japanese, the South Koreans, which is a large part of the so-called six parties. And then he is to go to Pyongyang. He has been invited. Previously, when nothing was happening, the North Koreans said, don't come, to Mr. Bosworth. I think this is a tremendous improvement.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let us do that. Someone in DeKalb, up in the northern part of the state, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Are you saying that we should just drop our intentions of being nasty to them and just go up and start talking to them? Is that the impression I get that you're giving from you, that we should just start dealing with them? Forget being all the rhetoric and just being nice to them?
Well, I don't know as being nice to them is what's in order, but I certainly believe that UN sanctions are totally counterproductive. Today's announcement that they have succeeded, who knows whether they actually have, in enriching uranium, which is another way their bomb is plutonium. This is another way to get to a nuclear bomb. This is a direct result, explicitly stated by North Korea and obvious to anyone who's paying any attention, the direct result of the UN sanctions. Being tough. We've been tough for 60 years. It has achieved nothing. I am not saying we should give away the store. I'm not saying we should hug them and kiss them and be sweet to them. I'm saying that we should sit down and negotiate seriously. All the time, of course, keeping in mind our own interests.
Well, that's the problem I have, is that we've done it with Iran, Iraq, Cuba. And I agree with you. It's almost like a waste of time. But see, we don't have any help either. We're the bad dog now because we went into Iraq. And, you know, I mean, personally, I think Korea, and the only reason I say this is because my next-door neighbor's kids and a bunch of them went over there as Christians, and not to North Korea, but to South Korea, and as, you know, like, I want to say young adult conservation corps type people, whatever, you know, I forget. They're telling me the things that's going on in the North. I mean, they treat their people like garbage.
They treat their people very badly. And being tough, as we have, has not done a single thing to help those people.
I kind of help.
It may make us feel good, but it doesn't do them any good.
So what would you suggest? I mean, let's just personally thinking, you know, we're in an economy right now that just really stinks for everybody. And I'm the last one that wants to send people or money over to another country that really doesn't give a squat. I mean, it's offensive to me that this country spends billions of dollars overseas on stuff. And you're right, that the system works is, you know, the bottom line is unless we change the system and what we give to them and show we mean business, which we don't, because it goes different in each administration that comes in, is it's never going to change. And I feel offensive when we give, you know, like Clinton went over there and got these girls free, but it's kind of offensive at the same time, because now the Koreans are looking at us, well, we can get anything we want. You know, and their point.
They know better than that. They know much better than that. They understand us a hell of a lot better than we understand them.
Well, let me here. I think this is an excellent opportunity to ask a question about that, because it seems that, you know, the tenor of so much of the coverage of North Korea is that it's not possible to understand them, that the North Koreans just don't make sense. They're often described as you know, being irrational, as if somehow it would just not be possible to understand what their worldview and their motivation is. And I'm sure you would say, well, that's just silly. Of course, understand
yeah.
it. So the question is, well, how does the world look to them, and what are the basic sort of principles that motivate their foreign policy and their engagement or lack of it with the rest of the world?
Well, first of all, in looking at North Korea, one must always be humble. We do not really know what's going on there in detail. Our intelligence agencies have satellites that show where this, that, and the other thing is, where they're going to launch the next missile from. But it doesn't tell you anything about daily life in North Korea. The evidence that we have from defectors and visitors and so forth is that life there is very bleak and very unfair, and that anyone who shows the slightest criticism of the government is apt to find himself or herself in a prison camp and so forth. It's a miserable situation. But it seems clear to me that it is a miserable situation. It has been just like that for 60 years. So why, if you're beating your head against the wall and it hurts, do you beat your head against the wall even harder? That is what we are doing. This business of following North Korean ships and railroading sanctions through the UN, and so this is not doing any good. Yes, it may cost something if we negotiate and we do as we did before, promise to build nuclear electricity generating plants and so forth. There will be some costs. But these costs are absolutely minimal compared to the $2 billion we spend in Vietnam. In Iraq. I think maybe it's more like $4 billion that we spend in Iraq every month. Anyway, this is something for an Iraq expert to tell you. But it's an enormous amount of money. And we have kept American troops in South Korea ever since the armistice in 1953 at a tremendous cost and have achieved very little. It is true that war has not broken out again, and that is a very good thing. And if we just cut and run without negotiating some kind of reasonable arrangement, then that might be dangerous. And I don't advocate simply saying, oh, this is useless, let's go away. What I'm talking about is an active negotiation. North Korea has committed itself to doing away with its nuclear weapons. If you read the agreements of September 19th, 2005, and of February 13th, 2007, you will see, even though neocons and others in the U.S. often say they haven't committed themselves, they have committed themselves. So what if that's the case, why are they not doing it now? Well, it's because they feel that they have been betrayed, that our side, South Korea and the U.S., has, and Japan for sure, have not kept their part of the bargain. When Lee Myung-bak threatens to repudiate the agreements that were painstakingly worked out between the South and the North in 2000 and 2007, they feel threatened. And when the U.S., instead of saying, we have problems, we should sit down and talk, instead moves to get U.N. sanctions, they don't feel obligated to keep their bargain when we're not keeping ours, in their view. And I think, in fact, we are not keeping ours. So that is the crux of the matter. Mm-hmm. It's nonsense to say that North Korea cannot be convinced to make these agreements and follow through on them. I firmly believe that they will, if the agreements are firmly in place and are followed by our side as well as theirs. The key to all of this, and I never see this in the press, is there is no peace treaty ending the Korean War. An attempt was made in 1953-54 to negotiate a peace treaty. It failed. There's an armistice agreement only. An armistice agreement which South Korea never signed. So South Korea is, in North Korea's view, is outside of the arrangement, although they have now agreed that they can be in the arrangement. But if we would move, not on the surface and these distracting peripheral issues, but to have a real negotiation to come to a peace treaty. And George W. Bush and Nomuhyun made a public statement in 2007 that there ought to be a peace treaty negotiated. Well, I don't agree with George about much, but I certainly agree with him about that. And if we could do that, then I think it is possible to negotiate a real end to this threatening situation.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Edward Baker. He is a member of the Executive Committee of the Harvard Korea Institute and has had a very long association with the Harvard Yenching Institute, interested since the late 1920s in research and teaching and publication about East Asia, and he certainly had been following politics in Korea for a long time. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You know, I think
I'd like.
Oh, yes, sir. Go ahead.
Sorry, I'd like to volunteer something that was suggested to me by one of the earlier callers.
Yes,
who came perilously close, I would say, to blaming Kim Dae-jung and the Sunshine Policy for North Korea's nuclear achievements. Mm-hmm. I think this is totally misguided. The person who we have to thank for North Korea's nuclear test in 2006 is none other than George W. Bush. He repudiated the agreements of 1994 at the end of 2002. North Korea then withdrew immediately from the NPT, kicked the foreign inspectors who had been there by that time for 8 years, kicked them out, and went back to work. Then on their nuclear program, probably, but at least they reactivated their nuclear reactor and so forth. It's complicated and detailed situation that I don't think I should go through all of right now. But the next step was that eventually North Korea came back to the table of the six-party talks and an excellent agreement was worked out. And it was announced on September 19th, 2005. And on the same day, the U.S. Treasury Department, like a bull in a china shop, declared that a bank in Macau called the Banco Delta Asia was to be boycotted by the entire international financial system because it was laundering, and I'm not sure whether it was or not, but even if it was, laundering North Korean ill-gotten gains in the international financial world. The same day, from the same podium. And when I asked about this. You know, was there some kind of coordination between the State Department and the Treasury Department? Oh, no. If that's true, if there really was no coordination, then that's utter incompetence. If there was coordination, that's utter incompetence, because naturally, as anyone who knows anything about North Korea would have expected, the North Koreans immediately said, no deals. We're not having any six-party talks. We're not following through on this agreement we just made while you guys are putting more sanctions on us. And the U.S. kept pushing for six-party talks, and North Korea kept saying, we have to have our two highest negotiators meet and work out this financial thing, and then we'll go on. And in the meantime, they exploded a nuclear device a year later. Now, this stalemate was, it's George W. Bush's responsibility, whether he actually was involved in the decisions or not. And this is why we have what appears to be a nuclear-armed North Korea, at least a North Korea that can do a nuclear explosion and then later another nuclear explosion. So this doesn't work. This is absolute futility to continue in this vein. And when we see today's New York Times, it says that the North Koreans have announced that they have followed through and are now able to enrich uranium because they did this because of the UN sanctions. Where are we going?
It's often said that one of the problems we have in this country is that our memory only extends back to the last administration. And it makes me, mm-hmm. again, think about you touched on the fact that when Bill Clinton was president back in the 90s, there was this attempt to improve relations between the two countries and the United States.
And they did improve.
And the United States made some commitments, at least the administration made some commitments, to do things like particularly help the North with their energy needs. And those commitments were never fulfilled. And one wonders if we had actually managed to keep those promises. That I think what happened was there was a change of control in the Congress. The Republicans took over and said, we're not going to do this. And it never happened. One wonders if the agreement that the Clinton administration had reached or had actually been carried out, whether things would have gone differently or how things might have gone differently.
Well, Colin Powell said in 2002, we are going to build, in the case of North Korean relations, we are going to build on what the Clinton administration did. If only that had been done. He was repudiated the next day by the administration. And by 2001, President Bush was announcing this famous Axis of Evil speech, which did tremendous damage to U.S. interests. And it was just a short distance from there to the events of 2002, which led to the U.S. government's repudiation of the 1994 agreements. It was exactly the opposite of what Secretary Powell proposed. Mm-hmm. He was right. And we wouldn't be where we are now with a nuclear-armed North Korea if Secretary Powell had been heeded.
Let us talk with some other callers. Chicago next, line 4. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes?
Could you address the weight and effectiveness of China's position in relation to Korea? It seems to be closer proximity geographically, of course, and how it may weigh upon making Korea come to terms. Thank you.
All right.
Yes. Well, this is a very, very important question and something that I probably should have alluded to earlier. History matters, you know, and China intervened in the Korean War. They warned us through the Indian Foreign Service that if the U.S. threatened to invade China, which it did, MacArthur explicitly talked about invading Manchuria and about using nuclear weapons against northern China, that they would come in and fight. And they did come in and fight. And the reports that I've read say that 500,000 Chinese soldiers were killed. I don't know if it was really that many, but it was hugely costly. And this was part of an ongoing relationship. The core of the Korean army was Koreans who had fought on the side of the Chinese communists in the Chinese Civil War. And they were sent back to Korea, and they formed the Korean army. And this was seen by the Chinese as an expression of their gratitude toward the North Koreans for what they had done during the Chinese Revolution. And then they sent all these people to fight, including Mao Zedong's son was killed as a soldier. So on the one hand, there is kind of comradely alliance. And then probably far more importantly, look at a map. If North Korea, if the government of North Korea were to implode or to be beaten militarily, that would mean instantly that U.S. and South Korean troops would be on the border of China. This is not in China's interest, and China is very leery of it. Among other things, it would mean that China's freedom of action against Taiwan would be drastically inhibited. I certainly hope that China will never decide to solve the, quote, Taiwan problem, unquote, by sending military forces against Taiwan. But there are those in the leadership in China who think that option has to remain on the table. And if the U.S. and South Korea are on the border, that option can't be used. Those American troops would then be 400 or 500 miles away from Beijing. You know, Beijing is not in the center of China. It's in the northeast. People used to go regularly from Korea to Beijing walking. It's not a distant fear. And so China will support the North Korean government with fuel and food and do anything it can to see to it that the North Korean government does not collapse. They may have voted yes on these sanctions, but there's no way that they're going to enforce them. And the sanctions provide for such things as, under some circumstances, boarding North Korean ships. Well, the Chinese have made it clear that nobody's boarding any North Korean ships in their waters. A while back, a couple of years ago, a lot of people in this country were talking as if all we have to do is persuade China and then China can tell North Korea what to do. Well, that is a very naive point of view. China cannot tell North Korea what to do. They can starve North Korea to death if they decide to do that, which is not in their interest to do, for a number of reasons. The one that I've mentioned already, but there's also the reason that if North Korea collapses, instead of a few hundred or a few thousand North Korean refugees going into China per month or whatever, there will be a million or several million there instantly. And China is not in a position to absorb that or to have the wherewithal to deal with it. And they certainly don't want it. So the U.S. cannot China cannot tell North Korea what to do. It can support North Korea or it can pull the rug out from under North Korea, but it cannot tell North Korea what to do.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I have one more caller I'd like to try to see if I can get in here. Mm-hmm. So let's do that. Line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I'll try to be brief. A lot of facets to this question, but just on the one thought, my thought is that, and I'd like your assessment, no country is, like, usually suicidal, and the use of nuclear weapon anywhere in the world by North Korea would pretty much end that regime, wouldn't you think? And
like, I would think so.
And is that really, so to what extent is that a danger? I mean, is this something of a chimera? Like, you know, so they've got, you know, the Russians had thousands of weapons, and Stalin and all these people in charge, and they were a little bit off the wall. But Kim Il-sung is like, you know, an alien. I mean, an alien like he's from space. He's not totally sane. Would you agree with that too? And I'll just leave it there and let you talk. Thanks.
Well, I think that Kim Jong-il is ruthless, and he is out to see to it that he, and as his mortality becomes apparent to him, one of his sons stay in power, but he's not insane. He's certainly not insane. He is very intelligent and very rational within his own system of beliefs. Look back at what Madeleine Albright had to say after spending 12 hours talking with Kim Jong-il. He's intelligent, well-informed, and rational. He's not nice. He's not a humanitarian. But he isn't crazy. And part of what has gone wrong all along with American policy toward North Korea has been the notion that he's insane and before him his father was insane. Well, his father was crazy like a fox. I don't think Jong-il is nearly as able as his father was, and he certainly doesn't have the charisma that his father did. But, you know, the reason that North Korea stopped nuclear development in 1994 and suspended it until much later was that Jimmy Carter accepted a longstanding invitation from North Korea to go and meet with Kim Jong-il. And these two older men agreed that the problems, whatever they are, ought to be solved by peaceful negotiation. And then Kim Jong-il died like 2 months later or 1 month later. And that agreement made it possible for the negotiations to go on, which led to the Geneva Accords. If Kim Jong-il had not made that agreement, I'm sorry, Kim Il-sung had not made that agreement, the father, it would have been impossible for Kim Jong-il, the son, whose whatever charisma he has is entirely borrowed from his father. If his father died saying, fight the bastards, well, then that's what would have happened. It would have remained a total standoff. And we need to recognize reality. And I just wish that the American State Department and so forth would pay more attention to history. Yeah. There are individuals who are very well informed, but we don't pay enough attention.
We are going to have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. Mr. Baker, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate
it. It's been my pleasure.
Our guest, Ed Baker, he is a member of the executive committee of the Harvard Korea Institute and a longtime associate of the Harvard Yenching Institute, someone who has been following Korean politics for quite a long time. Programs here on WILL, made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting El Nora, the Guitar Festival, September 10th through the 12th. More information on this event at krannertcenter.com. The broadcast also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevette Mansion across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio. We are WILL, and WILL is a member supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk with dog trainers Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel. In Kansas City, September wheat is currently trading at 479.5, down 4.25. December, 492.75, down 6.5. Kansas City, September wheat, 448, down 3 1/4. December, 474, down 4 3/4. September corn, 301 3/4, down 9 1/4. December, 308, down 7 3/4. March, 321, down 8. May, 330 1/2, down 7 3/4. September beans, 960 1/2, down 21 1/2. November, 926, down 15 1/2. January, 930, down 15 1/2. March, 931 1/2.